You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 14th of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Studio 2 at Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what's been flying off the shelves in the world's freakiest bookstore.
We get some people coming into the shop and then they'll pick up a book and I'll hear a gasp or a giggle or something like that, and then they call their friend over and say, oh, come and have a look at this, you know.
We'll also be reviewing some music with Robert Lewis, founder and co-owner of Brighton-based independent record label True Thoughts.
And we'll be working our way through the pages of a selection of magazines with Carole Mompard, director and art director of The Plant Journal.
So lots to look forward to, as ever, this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio 2 at Midori House, where we are for a change. This is The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Good afternoon, Gillian.
Hey, Andrew, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good. Well, back from France and I'm packing all my film.
What were you filming in France?
Well, I was with Mr. Bound, who you were talking to last week, and we were filming the Rencontre d'Arles, which is an amazing, amazing film festival in southern France that really takes over the whole town.
What were the highlights for you?
Well, it was funny. I mean, we'll talk about the highlights in the film, which is coming out hopefully on Monday. But it was the most amazing place to people watch, because I've never, ever seen in one place more people with cameras. But as cameras are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, the people here are carrying these huge cameras with huge lenses. And it's almost like they're all ready to go off on a safari, but there are no animals. All there are, like, exhibitions of photographs, but they're all kitted out as if they're off on some huge expedition with their huge cameras. It was quite amusing.
It is unusual that you say, I mean, has it got to the point now where you think filmmakers are now willfully carrying unnecessarily large cameras so they actually distinguish themselves from every Yahoo with an iPhone?
It's an obsession as well. You know, they are compulsive about their gear. And I think you're absolutely right. When everyone's taking pictures on iPhones and mobile phones, they're going, No, we're the real deal, and we got our long lenses. It was great. So we're just dusting off our film, which will premiere on Monday.
And where can people see the film on Monday?
Oh, it's going to be on monocle.com, and the route to the films is through the program menu, and we'll sit there in the culture section.
Excellent. So that's from Monday onwards. Right now it's Saturday. It's coming up for 6.5 minutes past midday in London, and you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Sie sind Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
Londonboro, as a Monocle 24.
Londonan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, sinä Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que ninatteiro no a Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagat, ja.
So let's start today with our weekly visit to some of the world's best independent bookshops to find out what titles have been selling well in different corners around the globe.
First up, we're heading to Tel Aviv, specifically to the Sipur Pashut shop.
My name is Mira Rashti, and I'm running the Sipur Pashut bookshop. Simple story in English, actually. Sipur Pashut was founded by Roni Kremer and myself. We located in Neve Tzedek, the first Tel Aviv neighborhood. And the name of the store, the bookshop, is after Shai Agnon, who was a Nobel Prize writer. And used to live in Neve Tzedek in 1992, 1925. Most of our customers, it changed actually, because during the years it changed. We started, we have most, because the neighborhood was very small and tiny, so we were serving more the neighborhood people. The last 2-3 years it started to be more international actually, because there are a lot of tourists coming to Tel Aviv, and this neighborhood is very special because it's history, and we found ourselves that 2 years ago we have enlarged and actually create a new a library in English, the same little Sipur Pashut, but in English. David Grossman, Isha Borachat Mipsora, in Hebrew, and in English is To the End of the Land. And I know also that it was very famous abroad. Esther Horner, she located and living in Tel Aviv. She is writing in French, and her books are being translated to Hebrew. So the book I'm looking for actually is What Do We Talk When We Talk About Anne Frank, which was published by Nathan in England there, and it's going to be translated by Edgar Keret and the Keter Publishing House, and I think this year it's going to be published, and I think it will be very nice. It's 8 short stories, and he's writing very good short stories, and I'm also pleased with the translator, which is Edgar Keret.
That was Mira Rashti from the Sipur Pashut Bookshop in Tel Aviv.
And next up, we're off to Thessaloniki, to the Konstantinidis Bookshop.
My name is Evripides Konstantinidis, and I am the manager of the Konstantinidis Bookshop, which is the oldest bookshop at the moment in Thessaloniki. It was founded in 1955, and it's situated in the city center. We have a different approach of how to display the books and how to present the books to our readers. The store is decorated with graffiti of well-known authors. It has a very beautiful children corner, and it gives emphasis on giving the customer the relaxed atmosphere to browse inside the bookshop as long as possible. We are a Greek language bookshop, but at the same time we give a lot of emphasis on English books. The emphasis on English books started some years ago when we wanted to have the ability to bring more English authors in Thessaloniki, as they were never including Thessaloniki at their visits. And so we have brought a number of well-known authors like Victoria Hislop, like Jonathan Coe, Panos Karnezis, Alan Hollinghurst, Marina Luica, Louis de Bernier, the authors that never bothered to visit Thessaloniki until that time. Our customer range is quite big, I must say. It starts from students of the university, because don't forget that the bookshop, it's 57 years, it was initially an academic bookshop, and it reaches to people that are highly educated and very well informed of what they want to read. And so you really have some really wonderful conversations with this kind of readers that have an opinion about almost everything. So we do that as a very good interaction. In terms of literature, in terms of fiction, our main bestseller the last 8 months, I must say, a huge seller, is The Thread by Victoria Hislop. Tonima, as it is called in Greek. This has a very special, it's a very special book because it has a very special interest about Thessaloniki. It is written about Thessaloniki. Victoria Hislop came and spent a lot of time in Thessaloniki to read this, to write this book, and we tried to help as well. And it starts from the 1917, the big fire of Thessaloniki, until the contemporary years, 2008. And it takes a family from that period, how it developed, how they met each other. And it's a really nice book because it has a lot of research for Thessaloniki that no other book in terms of literature has achieved. Other books that are bestsellers here are books from Jeffrey Evgenidis, The Marriage Plot, which is called The Scenario Gamu in Greek, and also from from a Greek author, Sotty Triandafilou, is very popular here with her recent book, Η Αγάπη της Γεωμετρίας.
And that was the owner of Constantinidis Books in Thessaloniki.
And last but not least, we head to a kind of a favourite of mine, actually, the self-described world's freakiest bookstore. This is Polyester Books in Fitzroy, Melbourne.
Hi, my name's Adam Emsley, and my wife Jo and I run the independent bookstore Polyester Books in Fitzroy in Melbourne. It's quite an icon, actually, for this street in particular. It's been here for about 20 years now, and its tagline is the world's freakiest bookstore. But it's basically a place where we stock all underground literature, a lot of material that you probably won't find in mainstream bookstores, a lot of art, a lot of fiction and literature, but we also stock a very large selection of erotica and drug titles and psychedelic titles, atheism, religion, occult, that kind of thing. So it's stuff that people might think about, but they don't necessarily go looking for as such.
Yeah, that'd be good actually today.
When you first walk in, we have a lot of more sort of odd mainstream and arty type books, but the further you venture, by the time you get to the back, you realise that, that it really is quite different actually. We probably don't want to put the really raunchy stuff right up the front. A lot of people take one or two steps in or they just lean in. But it's really great when, you know, we get some people coming into the shop and then they'll pick up a book and I'll hear a gasp or a giggle or something like that. And then they call their friend over and say, oh, come and have a look at this, you know. I mean, that kind of thing, you know, kind of makes their day.
There you go, that one too.
Yes, thanks. One book that's selling really well at the moment, and actually it's been selling really well for as long as we've been here, is a book called Pichal. It's actually spelled P-I-H-K-A-L, and it stands for Phenethylamines I Have Known and Loved, and it's by Alexander and Anne Shulgin. Alexander Shulgin's a pioneering chemist in the field of psychedelic drugs. He's a professional chemist. He was working for a large chemical company in the US, and then he decided to go out on his own and start synthesizing and testing new psychedelic compounds. And this book basically gives a rundown of all the experiments he conducted, all the materials he synthesized. Probably the most interesting thing about it is the descriptions that he gives of the effects. He'll test it at certain levels and he'll write what the effects of it were. So yeah, it's a great reference book because it's got so many different psychedelics, and it's also a good little history book about his history as well. There's not really anyone who at that time sort of had the wherewithal to actually go forth and experiment with these kind of compounds. And a lot of the work that he did was really quite revolutionary. And this is a kind of document that people look back on in years to come and say, you know, this guy was really before his time.
That was Adam Emsley from the Polyester Bookshop in Melbourne. Your home turf, Andrew, and I think you've been there.
I have been to Polyester in Fitzroy in Melbourne. It is, it's kind of a bit pleased with itself, but in a way that Melbourne is, which is in a slightly more quiet way than my actual native Sydney is pleased with itself. But there's a very scabrous undercurrent to Melbourne's, I guess, underground alternative sector, and you see that in a certain strain of Melbourne rock groups, all of whom I'm sure have been patrons of Polyester, like Painters and Dockers, and This Is Serious Mum, who I'm sure were probably employed at Polyester at one point. But yeah, on Polyester's website, in fact, there's a testimonial from Frank Zappa, no less, in which he says the shop is full of perverts, throwbacks and degenerate gamblers. This well-appointed bookstore provides a home away from home for the connoisseurs of fine publishing.
Well, what I loved when I went to their bookstore, and you look at browse category, and normally, like, you see biography and history and fiction, and their browse category have things like occult, drugs and psychedelica, subversion, tattoos, and then weird and funny shit. What did you buy there, Andrew?
Probably the politics section's quite interesting. There's a lot of, you know, quite cranky left-wing head-banging conspirazoid variety literature, but they do actually have quite a good stock of properly dissenting political literature, and that's probably what I was buying there. The trouble is with buying books anywhere in Australia is that while everything in Australia is now calamitously expensive, books, which have always been ruinously expensive in Australia, are now just actually laughable. It's $35 and upwards for a paperback, which is approximately like spending $35 on a paperback. It's absolutely preposterous.
And is that just literally sort of distance and shipping, or is it?
It's largely to do with the expense of distribution and shipping and publishers trying to stay afloat in what is a fairly small market. But it's tough.
We were talking about the other week, we were talking about France and how the French government sort of tries to help its book industry. I mean, is there anything similar in Australia where, you know, if a bookstore has Australian books, is there some sort of reduced
I don't believe so. I do vaguely remember a row when Australia instituted a value-added tax a few years ago, or what was called a goods and services tax in Australia. There was a row about whether it would be imposed on books, and I think our somewhat philistinic government of the time came down on the side of taxing books, which just strikes me as the absolute mother of all false economies. But it's very, very tough for publishers and booksellers in Australia. And Polyester Books is something of a Melbourne institution, founded by a man called Gonzo Heglemeyer, which I suspect was possibly not the name on his birth certificate.
There seems to be a bit of kind of tongue and tooth-cheek irony here. Is that something a little bit Melbourne is sort of known for over Sydney?
It kind of is. That's the Australian sense of humour right there, which tends towards the very, very dry and deadpan. But Melburnians, and I say this as a nominal Sydney-sider with an enormous and possibly treacherous affection for Melbourne, but Melbourneites like to think of themselves as a little bit, not better is the right word, a little bit more sophisticated than their cousins up in Sydney. And I'm bound to say that I don't think they're altogether wrong about that.
Well, shall we move on?
We shall. It's 20 minutes past midday here on The Review, and you're listening to Monocle 24.
Wherever you're going this summer, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25-25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app, available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Bart's, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just head to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Olympics are coming to London. And to Monocle 24. From the 27th of July and throughout the Games, we'll be going faster, higher and stronger, bringing some of the icons of the Games into Midori House, as well as taking Midori House out on the road with a series of special shows from across the city. Monocle 24, keeping a sporting eye and an ear on the Olympics.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Andrew Miller.
It's time now for our weekly music review, wherein we call upon a guest to pick three songs and to tell us a bit about them and about what they think of them. Now, guest this week is Robert Lewis. He's the founder and co-owner of Brighton independent record label True Thoughts. Good afternoon, Robert.
Good afternoon.
Well, first of all, introduce your label to us. Tell us a bit about its history.
True Thoughts is an independent label. We're based in Brighton and we've been running for about 13 years. We've released sort of just a variety of music, from soul to funk to more recently we've had some dubstep and sort of grime influence music, but and down-tempo music as well. So we've got a variety of artists signed from all across the world, and we just like to push good creative music. That's the aim of the label.
Is it a tough or is it an easy time in Brighton to run your own record label? What's it like now these days?
I mean, we've been going for about 13 years. So when we actually launched the label, we were launching at a point where we knew that any music we release, people will be sharing it and copying it and swapping it. So the business template we set up was very much set up like that, so we didn't spend too much money. So at the moment, for us, the label is doing very well. We've had the Quantic and Alice Russell album out this year. It's been selling very well for us and been picked up and supported you know, by press and DJs all across the world. So I think at the moment, we're, as a label, we're in a position where we feel people are paying attention to what we do and supporting the music that we're releasing. So we're finding it okay, you know, it's not so hard, I suppose.
I mean, Brighton did suffer something of a portent of doom on this front this week with the closure of Rounder Records, the famous Brighton record shop. But have you found Brighton in general, as opposed to trying to do it in London, is Brighton a good place to try and run a business like this?
I think so. I think the really interesting thing about Brighton is it's a very small area. Although it's a city now, it used to be a town. And because it's quite small, there's lots of students. I think there's an energy in there that comes in a quite creative way that really helps. I think there's an interesting vibe with all different genres of music or art or... that creative element is really here, and I think that inspires people in different ways, really, and the fact that it's in a small area. We're also quite close to London, so from that point of view, you know, we're not away from sort of where the industry is, but I think we have our own identity here in Brighton as well, which we do enjoy. I think people, there's a quite relaxed pace of life in Brighton as well, I think, so that helps. Yeah.
I was interested to read that, you know, part of your business model is having your own agency, which works with ad agencies to license music for ad campaigns. You know, how does that work, and how important is it really for musicians to help them kind of survive and carry on doing their music?
It's actually nowadays, it's probably a big part of why we actually survive as a label, because we've had success in syncing music, you know, to TV, films and adverts. And in a way, it helps the artist that sometimes, you know, people are, you know, we have to admit they copy music for free, get swappy music for free. And in a way, it does allow us to survive and carry on releasing more music. But also it does help in that promotional way, where if people hear music on an advert, they often, you know, now it's relatively easy to find out who that song is by, and people do buy music on the back of being on an advert. We had Belrouche on a Mercedes advert, and we saw a huge sales spike. It was the 125th anniversary of Mercedes. And Belrouche, you know, relatively good selling act for us on the label, but their sales went up hugely when their music was used on an advert, which for us is a great thing. We aren't a major label. We can't afford to, you know, have pluggers getting us on mainstream radio. So it, in a way, it gets the music out there, which we appreciate.
And are musicians a little less sort of scathing maybe than they used to be about this association of their music and commercial means?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we always ask our artists if they're okay with, you know, if we with everything that goes on adverts. I mean, today we haven't been in a position where we've had to turn anything down because the artists were concerned about the product. So I think nowadays, you know, in that real battle of, you know, do you give up doing music and get a job that you don't like or are able to, you know, we've had that conversation literally where, you know, an advert has come in and the artist had said, oh, that's great, I'll be able to get some strings on my next album because of that. So, you know, that balance, I think it's fine. And if it's a product, you know, it tends to be, you know, cars or things that people may, you know, don't have any huge objections to so far. Let's see, you know, what the future holds.
Well, let's move to the music that you've picked for us today. What's your first track?
The first track is a new artist we've signed to the label called Jana Veldovit, the album is actually produced by her and Zed Bias, and she's a singer and a musician and producer from Croatia. And Zed Bias, who we've done a few albums with on the label already, introduced us to her. And this track, Pick Flowers, is sort of quite a deep, soulful track with that little bit of a sort of garage influence and strings. So it's quite a sort of melodic, deep sort of garage track, I suppose, would be the way to describe it.
Let's have a listen.
Anna Valdovit with Pick Flowers. Anna Valdovit, that is, in collaboration with Zed Bias. The first of three selections today on our music review by our guest, Robert Lewis of True Thoughts Records from Brighton. Robert, where did you find Jana Valdovit? I usually do better with that, with Balkan names, who is from, as you said, from Zagreb. How did this association begin?
Well, I knew her music. She's had some releases on the German label Compost Records over the years, so I actually knew her and used to play her music, but I never actually knew her, you know, directly. But Dave Zed Bias was working with her because she is a string arranger, and getting her to help with some music that he was doing, and she was talking about her solo album. So it was through Zed Bias that we the introduction was made with Jana for this album.
And what's your second track coming up? This is the Armstrong Brothers. Who are they?
Now, this is from a compilation on Harmless Records called Holy Spirit, which is a double CD compilation, which is all gospel records. But for me, I buy a lot of music, and sometimes you have to rely on compilations to actually introduce you to new music. And this is a whole body of work from artists that I've never heard of. And it was a really great soulful music. If you're into sort of deep soul music with that gospel feel, it's a highly recommended sort of compilation to buy. I think it might be out soon, or it's out now at the moment.
Okay, well, let's give it a try. This is Armstrong Brothers with Can You Treat Me Like a Brother?
Can you treat him like a brother, brother? I see that man over there. He's trapped in the ghettos and trying to survive. Can you treat him like a
And that was Can You Treat Me Like a Brother by the Armstrong Brothers. Robert, I love the idea of, you know, how you go about discovering your artists. Where are you looking now? How are you finding new work?
I mean, it still comes through recommendations from DJs or other artists I know. For example, Rodney Pease introduced us to, there's a singer that we're speaking to at the moment about potentially doing an EP with. So there's a little connection there, but also I do find music from demos that come through as well. So I'm always searching for music and listening out and buying records. It's a constant process as an A&R. You have to sort of try and keep on top of things, especially as an independent label. You want to make sure that you're releasing the best music that is out there as well. So that's what I try and keep on top of.
How do you make the judgment between something you hear and just like and something you hear and think you would quite like to appear on True Thoughts Records? Do you have a sort of formal or informal set of criteria in your head?
There is an element of that. I think, especially now, as the label's got a little bit bigger, I mean, when we first started it, I have to admit, it was very much, I was purely just signing music on what I like. Now, there is a little bit more of an element that we know what tends to work, so we tend to try and, you know, chat to the artists and find out if they're quite willing to gig and tour, if they're maybe a little bit more on top of things like the internet promotion and just have, you know, Twitter pages or Facebook and all of that. But I have to say, alongside of that, there's definitely room for us to sign music that we just like. And whether, you know, we sign music from people who've said we won't be able to tour this album, but it's such a great album that we just sign it and put it out. So we try and balance both of those worlds, really.
And you talk about touring. How important is touring? And where are some of the places to tour that really can be quite influential because of the nature of the music audience?
We find, I mean, it's no coincidence, probably the five best-selling artists that we have on the label are the five artists that actually tour and gig the most live. So we feel there's a huge correlation with that. UK does quite well for us. France is a good territory, and Germany and America is really beginning to pick up for us as well. So they're probably the biggest territories that we found a real correlation between when artists tour out there, how sales also improve as well.
Well, okay, well, with that, let's go to your final selection for today. This is Wiley and Dark E Freaka with Step 7.
Yo, Esky boy, Step 7. Hold tight, Darky. Hold tight on my Twitter, massive. Dan, no. Follow. All I gotta do is 3 steps and I'm there like 10 steps up, 10 reps up. Number 9 knows that he's coming off when 10 steps up. Substitutions get made and the player might score a couple goals, but 10 gets snuffed. I just keep going. Nobody getting a looking when he's flowing. Nobody showing the skills that he's showing.
That was Wiley and Dark E Freaker with Step 7. I'm not sure I'd want to live next door to somebody who really liked that record all that much.
Yeah, I mean, that record is probably, Darky Freaker, the producer, he makes really good club records, and he sent me the instrumental of that a little while ago, which, when I DJ out, I play that out, and it goes down really well, and then Wiley heard it, and it's now on top of it. Yeah, that's sort of the two sides to my taste of music. You'd had the gospel-y thing before this, and now this is a sort of noisier aspect for DJing out with, I think, so, yeah.
Quite a mix and a contradiction. So it does show that you're not just sort of going along with just one taste, that you do kind of mix it up and mash it up a bit.
Yes.
I mean, does that make it difficult to run a label? Because a lot of successful independent labels, certainly through the 80s and 90s, did sort of cleave to a particular aesthetic. If you looked at the successes of a label like Mute or 4AD, you kind of had half an idea what you were going to hear even before you put the record on. Do you think that there is actually a connecting thread that links all the artists on True Thoughts?
In my head, there is, but I think... It does cause us a few problems, especially with territories, certain territories. For example, with some of the hip-hop stuff we do in America, it doesn't translate for some people, that type of music. But I think where we're at the moment as a label, I think people understand that they may not like every release that we put out, but in the genre that it's concerned with, it's probably a good representation of that type of music in that genre. And I think that's what I've tried to establish with the label, is maybe check out what we're doing, and you may not necessarily like everything that we release, but, you know, in a year we'll put out between 12 and 15 albums, and hopefully, you know, at least 2 or 3 of those albums somebody will like. If not, you might, you know, potentially you might like more of those albums as well. And I think in this day and age as well, with people having so much access to different types of music, I quite like the idea that you know, we represent different forms of music as well as a label.
Robert Lewis of Brighton-based independent record label True Thoughts, thank you very much for your time on The Review this afternoon. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and we'll be back to leaf through a stack of this week's favourite magazines after this.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Willkommen till Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόντζεντα, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε Κασίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
Λόντωμπο, έζε Monocle 24.
Λόντζεντα, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
Τι Λόντρις, έσαι α Monocle 24.
Ο κυκινινάτηρο νοά, Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Do lyssna på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
And each week on The Review, we cast our eyes on magazines and the magazine industry to unearth new titles, changing trends, and applaud examples of well-thought-out publishing. Now, today we're joined by Carol Montpar, who is director and art director of The Plant Journal. This is a botanical magazine with a difference that brings together photographers, illustrators, designers, musicians, writers, and artists from all over the world to share their perceptions and experiences around plants. Welcome, Carol.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit more about Plant Journal. It's something that we've coveted here and keeps desk hopping. And I love the tagline about its original plants. It's about original plants or normal plants, everyday plants and other green things.
Yeah, like, I think we really like this in a way that we are not experts on plants. So we want to do a magazine for all these people that have plants in their houses and just try to keep them alive. And sometimes you can't. so, yeah, like, we we started years ago and we just realized that there's like loads of creative people working about plants. And we couldn't find a magazine that was like the talk about it. So yeah, it's like for all these people that is interested in plants, but like they are not experts. Basically.
It's funny because you can often find it at a dinner party, people from all walks of life, all professions, completely different in every way. Yeah. But suddenly you unearth this kind of private personal passion that they like growing things.
Yeah. It's like, it's amazing the way we started the project and we there was like a moment we just like started contacting people and there's like loads of enthusiastic people that love plants. And we didn't know. I mean, like, it was not supposed to be a magazine. It was supposed to be just a fanzine, something smaller, just a printed like matter. But then, yeah, then it becomes something bigger because like all these people was just helping so much.
I mean, have you found that Plant Journal, and I was interested in that because as luck would have it, I've just had a massive derelict back part of my garden cleared out, so I now need to think of things to plant in it. But has it been especially popular in Britain? I was thinking of that line in George Orwell's essay on England, Your England, in which he sort of rather dismissively snorts at his compatriots as a nation of gardeners and flower lovers.
Yeah, I know, yeah. Actually not. I think like people started knowing about the magazine from second issue. We launched first issue in Barcelona, so I think it stayed there, like some local thing. But then I decided to move to London, so we started to... Like, we did the lunch party of second issue in London and everybody. And I think, yes, of course. I think London, like, the moment people just discovered this, I was like, wow. And for me, it's been a really good discovery as well, how England, you know, have, like, these amazing gardens. Yeah, it's blooming and everything, yeah.
And maybe before we go on to some of your other picks, I mean, talk about what I found interesting is it's not necessarily the usual kind of stories about plants. Just give the listeners a bit of an example of some of the kind of stories you'll touch upon.
Yeah, are you mean next issue or
in general, kind of stories you've done?
Yeah, I mean, it's grateful because they're like, there are some stories we just like, no, we want to do, or some editorials, they're like stories, okay, we really want this for next issue. But then we get loads of submissions of people with amazing stories. We actually got like an email from this girl, Annette, that she found amazing pictures of her grandfather documenting the garden for ages. So she just sent us like these photos and she really wants to do something with it. So we're like working together. So it's like something, you know, it's like we work on it, but at the same time, it's people giving us ideas all the time. So like this is amazing. This is really good.
No, I'm just saying there's an interview in here with a musician called Simon Petrovic, who's talking about how he encourages frogs and toads in his garden, which I'm very keen to do myself. I have a lot. It's really exciting. And I'm now just talking about my own garden, but it had one quite established pond, but one derelict one near the back. And I've re-established the derelict pond in order to try and make the frogs sort of happy. But they've found it already. It's quite exciting. There's now this kind of like frog way, if that's a word, traversing the length of my garden.
There you have it. Angie's garden.
You should come and take pictures of it. They're quite handsome frogs.
Sounds more like a radio show with the sounds of frogs. So, Carol, you have a lovely pile of magazines. What's the first magazine you want to bring to our attention?
Okay, I chose the magazines. Well, I've got, to be honest, all my copies in Barcelona, so it was difficult for me because I just moved in October, so I have just a few magazines in my room at the moment. It's something I need to think about, how to move all my books and magazines. But I just chose this Kaleidoscope magazine. It's like a contemporary art and culture magazine. And for me, it's pretty amazing the way it's like a redesign example I bring. It's like this like Italian magazine. And then just decided to redesign it this year with this graphic design studio, OKRM, in London. And like for me, the really good thing of Kaleidoscope is like how graphic design, you know, helps you to to the content. I mean, it's graphic design in here that helps you to know where things are. And they, I think they are playing really good with very visual stuff. I mean, the Index, for instance, they have like, they're like a photo for like for each page and content. And it's very easy for you to get into that. They also, I think it's very interesting the way they use old style layout. They just like, it's like a very modern magazine, but they just like for the captions and footnotes, they use all the time, like very old style layout that I actually love. There's this book, I used to work in a, like in a graphic design studio in Barcelona, and we had on the table this amazing book. It's like 500 years of book design, and it's like all about old style layouts that are actually layouts that are done because want to help the reader. I mean, because of the information. And now sometimes things that you're just like designing because of like, you wanted to make it beautiful.
I think it's very easy for magazines, and you see it on online content as well, people trying to out-clever what are the obvious basics. It's just, I always want to write to kind of bloggers or magazines who decide to make it look cool by putting white writing on a black background.
Exactly.
And you just want to write them and say, no, there's a reason why a consensus settled around black writing on a white background.
Because
this is making my eyes bleed.
Well, another thing like about Kaleidoscope is like that I really love, because I think the Plan Journal feels the same. It's like when you start something, but you keep changing first issues. It's like the Purple Fashion magazine, that I have this book where you can like see all the story, and it started when with one like design, and then kept changing for 2 years since they got like the.
So you do you know, mean a sense of evolution that you just not locked in? You see the process of it growing.
Yeah, exactly. You see like issue one and issue two, and like totally different, but it's still the same thing.
And what I just say with Kaleidoscope, it's like a lot of the magazines that come across this desk for the reviewer are quite handmade. They're quite raw. This is glossy. It's very glossy. Yeah. It's very well published and very well advertised as well.
Yeah. It's like, well, if you see, I think like this is like issue one with the redesign, so it's like totally different to issue two. Mm-hmm. I think maybe issue two they realize all these R magazines and culture magazines like are now, I think, getting into very like glossy paper. I think it actually helps. So yeah, I really like, I love the like the stuff like this graphic design studio does, and I think Kaleidoscope is a really good example for redesign magazine.
Do you think it gets much of a readership outside the professional graphic design circles? Is there much of interest in there for the passing reader, or is it mostly for its fellow professionals?
In terms of, you know, it's for art and contemporary art. Are there people beyond the art world, do you think? Does it have a wider interest?
Yeah, I think, of course, like, they need to, like, be involved. The thing, like, what I love here, if you go to the credits, they are not only the graphic designers, they are just totally involved to the content. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it's because I do the Plan Journal, so I'm totally involved to the content, that I really, like, appreciate what graphic designers just not design, just do something else.
And this is published in, I think, Milan. Is it an Italian publication?
Yeah.
I mean, do you find, in terms of for graphic design, there are different sort of cities that are really quite exciting when it comes to new thinkers in the print world?
At the moment, I'm actually quite happy that, well, I really would like to mention, like, Apartamento magazine is, like, they're, like, friends, and they're from Barcelona, so I'm quite happy at the moment that they're, like, magazines doing, like, pretty good in Spain. But obviously, what I think Spanish publications needs is just to get a little bit more international, and it's actually quite difficult for us. But, yeah, like, talk like Japan have like amazing publications that we actually like, it's very difficult to get. It's like Here and There magazine, that one that I really like. And yeah, like Italy is actually a weird example for magazines. Like, I don't really know any like amazing or super great Italian magazine, but like Kaleidoscope, I think like it's just like the publisher that is Italian, so he just came to London to look for some help for the design.
And what's the next magazine in your stack over there?
Yeah, this is Verities. It's quite a new magazine. I actually met the guys just a month ago, they emailed me. Yeah, they're really, like, really nice guys. And we met for a tea. And we're talking about magazines, because what I really like of this magazine is just they are on the same point maybe as the Plant Journal. But Plant Journal is like a small publication, self-edited. And we had an amazing chat about how difficult it is to get into that stage and how difficult it is to print every issue, you know, very specific things that we only understand. And yeah, and then I remember they emailed me and I just discovered the magazine 2 weeks before that. And I was like so surprised, because it's such a simple, simple design. And you can feel that it's like, I don't know, in a way in magazines you can feel with when something is very personal. Mm-hmm. Like you can feel in Verities like something that they put so much effort on it. And maybe I feel the same at the moment. So, yeah, and I mean,
this one is clearly totally a labour of love. There's no advertising of any sort in it. I also couldn't help but notice, because I am just absolutely humorless fascist about such things, an awful lot. They do need a sub-editor.
Yeah.
Awful lot of misplaced apostrophes and your and there and there issues. But I am just a massive grouch about those.
So maybe describe first, though, what Verities sets out to do. It's a biannual magazine. And maybe if you can set out what it looks like, what its raison d'être is.
Well, it's a Vienna. I think, like, they are trying to, like, set up, like, dates. But I think they're actually very, very like that. They're like just doing so much effort. And what I really like is the theme. They decided it's like the magazine for the ultra observant. It's so amazing how you can find magazines about everything at the moment. I think there was like a moment for magazines at the 80s, 90s, where Wolfgang Tillmans and Kate Moss like were there. And there was like a very big cultural thing. But I think after the 90s, it went down. And now, I don't know if it goes internet or something, but just like, you can find publications about everything. And it's amazing how the editor or the person that decides to do a magazine choose the theme. And here's like the magazine for the ultra observant. I mean, they choose a concept. So everything or all the stuff you can find around this concept fits in the magazine. And I think this is, I just find, for instance, like this last issue is about the muse. Mm-hmm. The muse that like is a concept that it's almost forgot, isn't it? Like the muse, it's like from ages ago. And I think they did a really good work asking the right people to do the photos, really good conversations. And everything about the muse is just like nothing else.
It's a beautiful looking magazine. And I do like the paper, which manages the matte paper, at least, manages a feel. On the one hand, it feels a bit like a sort of Samizdat fanzine thing, but on the other hand, it's also clearly very expensive and very good paper, which is a neat balancing trick.
Yeah. You can feel, I think what I really like as well is that, what you say, it's like you can see it's fresh. Mm. I mean, I think for me, there are two types, like different magazines. One that I have like amazing and brilliant art direction, and I can talk about Fantastic Man and Gentlewoman, that they are like brilliant. But then this is like a very, you know, rule and setting up like very perfectly things, and the art directors, we choose this art director. So for magazines as Verities, as the Plant Journal, that are actually starting. So we have not an art director to work for all the photography.
It has picked up some advertising, I noticed, in issue two as well, which is a good sign.
Yeah, well, if you want, we can talk about advertising for the Plant Journal later.
You mentioned when you were talking about the issue you liked, and you said there are good conversations. And I think it's interesting because sometimes you sense in some of these magazines that they're done not just for the reader, but also for the people who are writing, that they enjoy the notion of having these conversations. It's almost a throwback to the salons of, say, the 20s and 30s. And conversations is maybe what people are responding to when they actually choose to buy a magazine and not go online.
Yeah, I think conversations, and we realize also in the Blind Journal that interviews, it's very, like, for the reader, it's very easy. It's actually easier for me when you buy, like, newspaper on the weekend and the supplement. You go straight sometimes to the interviews, like the most easy way of reading. So, yeah, I think conversations, and I think it's Abake, like this graphic design studio in London. They have like an editorial, and they started to do these small books, and it's just about interviews, but interviews not to very famous people, just interviews. And it's like something curious about conversations and when those two persons are like, I think talking to each other.
There is a good balance actually in these two issues of Verites. There's a quite good interview in one of them just with a man who has been in prison about what being in prison is like. And there's also a longer sort of more, I guess, traditional sort of interview with an author, in this case sort of grouchy literary elder Ian Sinclair, reiterating his complaint about CCTV cameras in London. But it is an interesting mix of personalities. But I do think it's an undervalued idea in magazines, just the interview with the person who you may not have heard of but does actually have a story to tell. And that's quite a good idea, just to talk to somebody who actually has been in prison and say, what's that actually like?
Yeah.
Which I guess fits in with the title of the magazine, Verites.
Verites.
And there was another magazine you are very keen on, but is very hard to find. So we don't have a physical hard copy of it here to leaf through, which we like to leaf through. But I'm curious to know and hear about it.
I think it's a magazine. I don't know. You know, like my two partners from the Plan Journal in Barcelona now listening to me. So I think they're going to be very happy. I chose like Here and There. Here and There is a magazine from Nakako Hayashi. She's like a Japanese editor. It's very difficult to find about her. It's very difficult to find what she's doing. But she's close friends of Ellen Flace that we featured in last issue with interiors. Here at the end, like she... I read a story about how she started the magazine. And it's like a very random story. Like she was talking to Ellen Flace. I was like, oh, I'm going to... I think it was Hawaii for holidays. And Ellen was like, okay, I'm going to New Jersey. Okay, so shall we put all the photos together about New Jersey and Hawaii and like do a book or something? And they were like, okay, let's do it. So that's like the way the magazine started. It's like Here and There. And
it does sound like one worth looking up, Here and There magazine. Carol Montpart, thank you very much for joining us on the magazine review, on today's review. You're listening to Monocle 24. And that brings us to the end of this weekend's Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here in Studio 2 at Midori House. The show today was produced by Alexander Mills and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond.
Next up, it's time for The Curator, where you can catch our pick of the week's best programmes on Monocle 24, from stories, guests and feature pieces. And don't forget to tune in tomorrow to the Monocle Weekly, Sunday, midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.